Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club. I'd also like to welcome our radio, television, and internet audiences and remind everyone that you can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Thomas Finger, Deputy Director of National Intelligence for Analysis, Chairman of the National Intelligence Council, and principal author of the recently released report on Iran's nuclear capabilities. Dr. Thomas Finger was Assistant Secretary of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research from July 2004 until May 2005, when he was named Deputy Director of National Intelligence for Analysis and Chairman of the National Intelligence Council. While at the State Department, he served as Acting Assistant Secretary for Intelligence and Research, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Analysis, Director of the Office of Analysis for East Asia and the Pacific, and Chief of the China Division. His intelligence career began in 1970 as the senior German linguist in the Office of the Deputy Chief of Staff for Intelligence, USAREUR, and 7th Army in Heidelberg, Germany. Between 1975 and 86, he held a number of positions at Stanford University, where I had the pleasure to get to know him, including Senior Research Associate in the Center for International Security and Arms Control and Director of the University's U.S.-China Relations Program. Other previous positions include assignment to the National Academy of Sciences as co-director of the U.S.-China Education Clearinghouse, advisor to the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment, and consultant to a number of U.S. government agencies and private sector organizations. Dr. Finger is a graduate of Cornell University with a BA in Government and History and Stanford University with an MA and PhD, both in political science. He's a career member of the Senior Executive Service of the United States. His principal foreign languages are Chinese and German. He has published many books and articles, mostly on aspects of Chinese politics and policymaking. Please welcome Dr. Thomas Finger.
Thank you, Gloria, and thank you for being patient. It's been a long time since I lived in this area and forgot what an accident can do to tie things up. Gloria's introduction may be longer than my talk, but she has included something that is inaccurate, having to do with the principal author of the Iran nuclear NIE. We did not work it out, but it could not have been a better thing to include in the introduction. Because what I would like to do this evening, with your indulgence, is to give a very broad brush overview of how we have gotten from the Iraq weapons of mass destruction estimate, which some claim caused the United States to go to war with Iraq, to the Iran nuclear estimate, which was released in December, and of which I am not the principal author, that I have been tagged as the author will tell you something about Washington. But right now I'm going to put the rabbit into the hat before we get to his removal. There is, of course, the saying that, I'm from Washington and I'm here to help you. I'm not. I'm coming from Washington, which, as many of you may know, is that political theme park of about 45 square miles surrounded by reality. And it is very nice to get out of that atmosphere. But the atmosphere is important to what I'm going to talk about this evening. I am part of a relatively small band of people who have been given the sort of once in a couple of generation opportunity to remake a major portion of the federal government. The intelligence community as it exists today has been in place, assembled, tinkered with, but largely unchanged for 60 years through 11 administrations. It's more than a quarter of the length of our country. For circumstances having to do with perceived policy, intelligence failures, we've been given a chance to do what 42 studies and commissions over the years failed to accomplish, namely to actually change this large enterprise. There are people who are impatient. I'm impatient. We've been asked, in essence, to take an aircraft carrier moving at flank speed and make a hard right turn. This is a big enterprise and change is difficult. Why do we even get the chance? What makes it different? I attribute this to largely two factors. One is 9/11, not the events, terrible as they were, but the 9/11 Commission and the political skill of the two co-chairmen, who made their agenda very skillfully the national agenda in election year. They did not, Tom Kaine and Congressman Hamilton did not allow these recommendations to just be put on a shelf. That the conclusions of that study coincided with the Iraq War, which has been blamed on one of the worst national intelligence estimates ever written. I was part of that process. Happened to be a dissenter, but that probably matters less than being a part of the process. We can talk about how it got to be so bad in question and answer. The important thing was momentum was built up to change institutions and procedures and practices and expectations that had been in place for decades. We were given this mandate with a very ambiguous, contentious piece of legislation, the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004, which wrote into law many of the disagreements that were unresolved between the administration and the Congress, between the Senate and the House, between Democrats and Republicans, and between members of different committees. And as is typical in the theme park of Washington, everybody thinks the law says what they wanted it to say, as opposed to what it actually says. But it did give us the chance, but it came with a not just ambiguous mandate, with a very large enterprise, 16 agencies, give or take 100,000 people. We've now published 1 year's budget, so give or take $40 billion. This is a very large undertaking. When the first six of us assembled in May of 2005, it took until April to get a confirmed director of national intelligence. We started out with an organization chart, a mission statement, a plan of action, a blueprint that consisted of a blank whiteboard. There was a certain what have we done moment. What are we going to do now to actually take advantage of this once in a half century kind of opportunity for change? The context was helpful to a point. The 9/11 Commission and the WMD Commission, the results of which were released after the law was passed, pointed to the need to do a number of things. Two primary among them were to integrate law enforcement and foreign intelligence. We had redefined national security after 9/11, somewhat unconsciously, we as a nation and our expectations. For decades, national security, the military of our country, the activities of the intelligence community, supported defense against foreign enemies, threats to the existence of our country, of our way of life, survival of our nation in existential terms. After 9/11, national security was redefined de facto to mean protecting every American citizen everywhere around the globe every day. What was a monumental task became many, many times more difficult. And bringing together law enforcement agencies, practices, people that had been separated for decades very deliberately to protect civil liberties in response to abuses of the 1960s, early 1970s, as well as cultural differences between what is permissible in dealing with foreigners outside of the United States in the ways of conducting business and inside the United States. The idea that we had to overcome cultural gaps, share information better, bring together people operating in the intelligence components of the Treasury Department, the State Department, the Marine Corps, together with the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And, oh yeah, this was complicated by the stand-up of the Department of Homeland Security, only portions of which were covered by the intelligence reform legislation. The context also gave us a couple of models. I will overstate it, because elements of both were present in both 9/11 and WMD reports. But one argued for dealing with the problem of cultural gaps and information sharing, failure to get synergy, by urging concentration, reducing the number of agencies, putting people together physically. If they work together, interact every day, they'll get to understand one another. They can pass pieces of paper, be on the same computer system. The alternative model was to integrate the disparate parts of this large enterprise into a truly single integrated enterprise, able to take advantage of the specialization that had developed. In the end, there were both structural elements and behavioral elements in this. As we looked at this, we decided we needed to tackle both, but in different amounts. My piece of this was the analytical component. My mission, to make analysis better. I'll come back to what that means. But as we stared at that blank whiteboard, decided how we were going to do this, very quickly realized that the situation of 16 disparate agencies was more an asset than it was a problem. They had come into existence for very reasonable causes to provide tailored support to agencies, to customers with different responsibilities. That what the Secretary of the Air Force needs to design hardware and tactics is very different than what the Secretary of State needs to fashion diplomacy, is very different than what the Secretary of Treasury needs to deal with international monetary problem. So as we looked at the situation, what started out looking like chaos, a Rube Goldberg operation, began to look more and more like pretty smart adaptive behavior. So the problem or the challenge became, how do we integrate? How do we break down institutional barriers, mythologies, mistaken assumptions, incompatible computer networks, rules that were put in place in the Cold War or earlier, other laws that were put in place to separate rather than integrate the portions of this? And we begin to say, we can make this work. But the first thing we had to do was find out what we had. Let me digress, and I'll make periodic excursions back to the theme park. The normal approach of Washington to any problem is more resources. The best way to get more money and more people is to screw up. I had sought and had postponed appointments with a particular member of Congress two or three times, scheduling problems. We finally had rescheduled, but I had changed jobs. I was no longer the Assistant Secretary of State. I decided to keep the appointment rather than try to reschedule. And we went in, and the very first question was, how many more analysts do you need? I said, I don't know, sir. I don't know how many I have. I don't know where they work. I don't know what they do. I don't know what they know. I don't know what their expertise, the basis for their expertise. I don't know what languages they speak. I don't know their technological grounding. It wasn't simply that I was ill-informed for the job I had undertaken. Nobody knew. In individual units, people knew what they had. But we had never attempted to look across the entire enterprise. And mapping became a very big challenge here. Finding out what we had as a baseline. It took almost a year. We talked for a while. It was actually a very constructive, pleasant conversation. And having spent 16 and a half hours on the Hill in the last 7 days, it's nice when you can say a conversation was both pleasant and constructive. But it ended with him saying, what do you need from me? I said, time. He said, that's the one thing I can't give you. I said, excuse me, sir, I've been on the job 1 month. It's going to take a while to do this. He said, yes, but you don't understand. We passed a law. And the American people expect results. Said, remember how we got here? It was a case of you want it real bad, you sometimes get it real bad. And the Iraq WMD estimate falls in that category. It was requested. We were given a 2-week period in which to produce it. And it was bad. It was really bad. A second aspect of the approach that I took to the analysis portion of it was making analysis better. It wasn't simply identifying all the cogs and getting them connected. It was end-to-end for analysis, because it was clear that it meant guidance to the collectors, not just of the expensive, high-risk, sexy kind of things we collect, but good old-fashioned academic writings, newspapers, broadcasts, which in the parlance of Washington is known as open-source intelligence. Normal people call it information. An awful lot is out there just to be had, and it's being used. Why steal it if you can get it for free? Why run any risk if it's not necessary? Why develop an expertise internally if you can reach out and engage with people in other parts of the U.S. government, across our country, or beyond our country? We needed to have connectivity with this. In order to provide better guidance for what we're going to expend money and effort to collect, one of the simple changes here was we used to ask analysts, what do you want? I want everything. It was a Dear Santa, from a six-year-old. I want everything. Whatever you get will be more useful to me than what I have now. We changed the rules to Aladdin and his lamp. Three wishes. But the motivation here wasn't arithmetic. It was, what is it that you think will help you to answer questions that will provide the maximum amount of understanding and insight to the people we support? What is it that's not simply an interesting factoid, but that is critical to understanding a complex situation? And you get three. Someplace, China's big, you get five for China. Those are real numbers. That's not me being facetious. And it isn't enough to say, this is what I need most, and here's the question I think it's going to answer. You also got to say where you think you can find it. It's not go off on a snipe hunt. It's look here. Try this avenue. It's begin to have payoffs. The middle is the analytic tradecraft, how one deals with laws of evidence and inference, explicating assumptions to close knowledge gaps. And remember, we're dealing in a realm that can be likened to a 1,000-piece puzzle. You've got 8 pieces, and somebody lost the box top with the picture. So there are lots and lots of gaps. What are alternative ways to explain the information you do have? Why do you think one explanation is better than another? What very explicitly are the assumptions you're using? Why are you weighing the evidence, spelling it all out? Being transparent. Having spent a lot of time on university campuses, having work that is reproducible, so that somebody looking at it will understand what you did and why you did it, and making that explicit. And then there's the output of this process. As I tell my younger analysts all the time, as exciting as this is, the goal is not to make us smarter. It's to make policy better, to make military actions more effective, to make law enforcement activities to protect us in the homeland more timely, more efficient, more preemptive, prevent things from happening, not simply catch bad guys after the event. I think even with that very broad brush summary, you can fill in the gaps in terms of why some of this would be unnatural, hard to do, require training. And as I looked at my workforce scattered across 16 agencies, it's actually more than that because there are portions of agencies that are involved. And we built a database, which we produced a phone book so you can actually find out if, who is it knows something about tribal economics in Mali. Say, why would you care about that kind of esoterica? It's the nexus between smuggling and terrorist activity, and it gets to why the government is reluctant to be disruptive. That it used to be very easy in the old days. They're on the side of the Soviet Union, or they are on our side. If they're on our side, what do we have to do to keep them there? If they're on their side, what do we have to do to persuade them to come to our side? Oh, that was simple. We had to know about weapons and missiles being built and submarines being launched and so forth. Now, to protect all Americans everywhere all the time, in a globalized world where if a sick person gets on an airplane in Congo and lands in the United States, we can have a problem with infectious diseases, where immigrant disputes spill over into our cities. Not all of these are bad, but understanding them is important. Identifying our expertise. And I discovered something that was totally obscured in my previous position. In the State Department's intelligence unit, we had procedures that really developed expertise. So when I left, the average time that an analyst had been working a problem was in excess of 15 years. Most of the larger community elected to deal with uncertainty by optimizing flexibility, by moving people around. It wasn't an irrational response to the uncertainties of the post-Cold War period. It just turned out to be disastrous. We ate our expertise, ate our bureaucratic seed corn. And as we looked across at the demography, it turns out to be the letter J, where there are the short leg are the gray-haired guys, the baby boomers, people like me, that are a couple of tuition checks away from retirement. The long leg is the now roughly 55% of the community that have joined since 9/11. Very talented, very eager, very committed, very professional, and very young, and very inexperienced. And that U trough of the J, the majors and captains, the senior NCOs, the 0201 Foreign Service Officer contingent that is critical for mentoring and training, don't exist. They were the product of the downsizing, right-sizing, hiring freezes of the 90s. So as I looked at this community, I said, oh my, we've got to be able to mentor and move expertise and interact it across agencies, not as a theory, but because if we don't do it, the most experienced people will be gone. The junior people won't have guidance. If they're floundering, they won't stay. Happily, the response of the community has been tremendous in this regard. There are a lot of other things that go into it. You talk about questions, evaluation of products, imposition of standards, reviewing of products, training for people in this, breaking down barriers that permit moving information across systems. There are some neat things that we've done, some of which have been written up, the IntelliPedia, a Wikipedia that is classified but is not anonymous, a different way of handling material. We can talk about those. Let me shift back into the what got us here. It's the Iraq WMD estimate. I think of this as having your yearbook photo taken on the worst bad hair day ever. The community was never as bad as that estimate. The number, the percentage of analysts who participated in a production of that hurry up, get it out the door in 2 weeks product was tiny compared to the larger set, all of whom were tarred with the same brush of incompetence. Half my workforce has joined the government since that estimate was produced. Their capability and credibility is questioned for something that happened before they got here. Restoring confidence in our work, in ourselves, in our colleagues, had to be job one here. And restoring confidence by earning it, by demonstrating that we really are capable of good work and we're capable of making it better. Going back to basics, out of the 9/11 and WMD Commission criticisms, the number one was the production of analytic products estimates. Number two was the president's daily briefing process. Not going to talk about that tonight, if there are questions. That's also mine. So in looking at what we could work at, I said, what's going to get the most scrutiny? It's an estimate. Where can we make things better fastest? It's using the National Intelligence Council, which has the role of integrating the community, of drawing in expertise from across the community, had that role for 50 years. It's now different, because it belongs to the Director of National Intelligence rather than to a single agency. But it was a natural testbed. for this, to impose new requirements, to mandate new steps be followed. The national intelligence officers that we have are as good as anybody in this country around the world. They truly are expert at what they do, and they interact easily with experts around the world. So their responsibility is to reach out and find the best people we have. I don't care what agency they work in. I really upset people by saying, I don't care what their job is. If they know something about the issue, I want to have them participate. As a function of moving people around, there are thousands of analysts who know more about the last job they had than the one they're in now. If there was somebody in a Peace Corps in Nepal, or a military officer who'd been a foreign area specialist in Kenya and is now doing something, they didn't get stupid on what they used to do. Wanted them identified and brought into the fold. We produce hundreds of products out of the National Intelligence Council. Very small percentage of national intelligence estimates. We use this not just as a demonstration, demonstrating to the Hill, demonstrating to the administration, demonstrating around the community, but because we were drawing in people to participate in their production from all of the agencies, they went back, having experienced work under the new and more demanding standards, and they were able to teach, to share, using each product as a teaching vehicle. Key changes here, transparency. A change that came before the Director of National Intelligence was done by George Tenet shortly after the Iraq WMD to insist that analysts be given more information about this, the material that they were given to work with, more information on the sources. And that was very, very important. More transparency into the analytic tradecraft, kind of things I described earlier. Alternative judgments. The system before drove for consensus. It was a misplaced use of democracy. Putting a bunch of people around the table, a large percentage on any given issue didn't know very much about it, and deciding what was the best analytical judgment on the basis of a show of hands. Democracy is great, but not for judging the value of analysis. We approached it from, if smart analysts with access to the same information are coming to different judgments, that's probably more important than who's right. And indeed, we began making these differences, disagreements, known to officials up to and including the president as soon as we identified them and were comfortable that this is a good tradecraft. The message is, before you commit anybody here, any official we support, sort of personal prestige or the power of this country, you need to understand that the ice under that judgment is thin. The yellow caution flag should be going up. Not in the old style, we get a consensus view or a majority view, and people were allowed to say, I don't agree. In the years that I was in the State Department, I literally took hundreds of dissenting views. I was never alone. The I here is institutional, not me personally. We learned all the time. There would be analysts scattered around who say, we agree with you. Our agency doesn't agree with us, but we agree with you. You're going into the fight. Can I hold your coat? That observation caused me to say, we need to move beyond sort of a federation of agencies coming together to build a community of analysts who don't pay any attention to the agency lanyard that's around their neck, that engage and mix it up. And as we begin to identify, to make transparent, to insist that people spell out the reasons for disagreement, to my surprise, we got fewer, not more, disagreements. Oh, now I understand why you come to that. And often we move to a different point. We're getting better product, and it's more useful to people that we support. Now let me roll it up. We've made a lot of products better. That more than a year ago, it became clear that we needed to do another serious look at Iran's nuclear program. We were getting pressure from the Congress, which had written into law, it never happened before to my knowledge, a requirement for a national intelligence estimate on Iran, happened to be on politics. We were pushing back on nuclear. So we'll do it, but you know, don't write it into law. Don't tell us the questions to ask, because it has too much of a, here's the bottom line, you go get there, character to it. But as it became clear we needed to do this, we did it, and the lessons of Iraq, we went back to scrub everything. No prior judgment was allowed to stand unchallenged. No previously examined piece of evidence was taken automatically to have the same meaning as it had been given earlier. The context here of the war in Iraq, the context of the intensive politicization of that war, and even though I had learned long ago in Washington, there are only two possibilities. There are policy successes and intelligence failures. You've never heard anybody claim the opposite. The intelligence was brilliant and the policymakers screwed it up. And you probably never will. That meant that what we produced on Iran's nuclear program was going to be scrutinized by the congressional oversight committees that had scrutinized. It took them more than a year to do their postmortem of analysis of the estimate that had been written in 2 weeks. They were ready to go to look at the next one that we did. Actually, the next one we did was on Korea. Didn't get that kind of scrutiny. There was a conviction in the minds of some that we were preparing to invade Iran. So get this estimate to it right away. We want to know if this is going to be another excuse for political action. We worked harder on this, I think, than we've, as a community, worked on any. I'm not the author of it. By the end of this, there were in excess of 100 people worked on this estimate. There were principal drafters for reasons I hope were more or less obvious. We never reveal the names of individuals. No. They pay me big bucks to be the guy that takes the bayonet. But I didn't write this thing. It was done by people who really know the subject. I read what I thought was the final draft in June. We were finishing it up to deliver as promised during the summer. It was a pretty good estimate. Basically, it confirmed what we had said in 2005. And 2002. There was some more detail. We answered some new questions. But basically, it hadn't changed anything. Right at that point, we got new information. Incredible new information. Sort of this guidance that I mentioned earlier to, you know, what is it that you want? What is it you need? What will give you them? The collectors did a fantastic job. And it wasn't one source. It was multiple sources. And it was voluminous information. And we went all the way back to the beginning. Said, how do we look at this new stuff in light of what we already knew? How do we validate the new stuff against what we thought we knew? Where there are differences, which one do you come down on? Hundreds of names, incredible technical detail in this. Bringing in specialists at the weapons labs to do this. A couple of months into it, we realized that depending on how we came out on the reliability of the information, we could be changing a critical judgment. And we began to alert people that we had not made a decision yet. Jury's still out, but it might change an important judgment about Iran's nuclear weapons program. Well, I'll fast forward. We reached the conclusions that we did. One of them, too, was to nail with much greater certainty than we had before the existence and the scope of a secret weapons program that Iran has never admitted, continues to deny. We identified that Iran continued to press ahead with two of the three critical elements of it, production of fissile material. If you don't have fissile material, you can't have a nuclear weapon, in violation of UN Security Council resolutions, and continued to move ahead with a missile program to deliver. What the estimate found was that in 2003, the Iranians halted the weaponization program and some other covert activities in response to international scrutiny and pressure. That's the way we wrote it up in the summary of this. Also went through another timelines, how long would it take them and so forth, that really were corroboration of things said. But what got attention when this was released, and that's another story here, we wrote this and said this should not be released. Sourcing is too sensitive. The arguments are too sophisticated. It was written for people who worked the issue, have the background. The fact that we had changed a critical judgment posed an integrity dilemma. Since two directors of national intelligence in 2007 were on record with Iran is determined to have a nuclear weapon. And I was on record, I was the last one to have testified last summer on threat hearings on this. Said, given the role of the American judgment in the international political debate, doesn't integrity require sort of telling the world we changed our mind on something? We changed our mind because we had new information. It wasn't sort of a whim that we had new information that led us to that conclusion. In a process that had looked at almost a dozen alternative ways of explaining what we had, the other was a conviction that it would leak. Again, back to the theme park. Things that are sexy, things that are political, things that could be sticks, pieces of it would leak. A decision was made to release a declassified version of the key judgments. The estimate is 140 pages long. It has almost 1,500 source notes. This would be one hell of an impressive dissertation. The summary is 2.5 pages. Actually got a little shorter when we cleaned up some of the sources and methods that we had to take out of it. We got ourselves now in another dilemma. Given the history of the Iraq WMD, where there was a white paper, a public version that was different than the classified version. It didn't acknowledge that there were dissenting views. So we had put in place some rules that said if you're going to declassify, it's got to be true to the original. Otherwise, it looks selective, cherry-picking, spin, and we don't want to go there. So now what came out was something intended to be classified for a sophisticated audience used differently. And I'll bring this to closure here. The characterization of me as the author, I know exactly where it came from. I won't share that with you tonight. But it got repeated and repeated and repeated. It was part of a very conscious, no need to deal with the substance of the product if you can have an ad hominem attack that discredits the product. And now a lot of people have worked their way through that classified estimate, and nobody has faulted the tradecraft. It wasn't done by one person. It was done by more than 100 analysts around the government, reviewed by specialists in the DOE labs, reviewed by outside specialists who were, you know, did we make this argument clear? It wasn't snuck by with some opponents of the administration that the National Intelligence Board that approves all estimates has six presidential appointees on it. I'm the former. I was a Bush appointee who resigned from the position to take this job. Five current or former flag rank military officers. This was not a bunch of sort of mealy-mouthed guys sort of led astray by wimpy analysts. This thing was looked at as seriously, as studiously as we know how to do. And the conclusions are mostly Iran is a real threat because, as the estimate says, it's a political decision away from restarting a program. It also says international pressure and diplomacy had an effect. It says there's a cost-benefit analysis in Iran. These are all important findings that have been obscured. Let me bring this to a close. We've got a ways to go to transform this big intelligence apparatus. I'm absolutely convinced that this time we will succeed. This won't be another study that goes in a dustbin. And I'm pretty confident by the end of this calendar year, serendipitous that it coincides with the end of the administration, just it will have taken 4 years to do this, that the benefits will become sufficiently obvious. The new patterns will be ingrained with a workforce that largely has no knowledge of the bad old ways of the past. Nobody will want to sweep it aside. And though if anybody did, it'd be too hard. The cement will have hardened. And we will be in for something that we will have probably for decades. I'm proud to be a part of it because I'm sure it's better than what we had. Now I'll respond to your questions. Can you stand here? Sit down.
Our thanks to Dr. Thomas Finger, Deputy Director of National Intelligence and Chairman of the National Intelligence Council. Now, we have a myriad of questions, and I'd like to start with one going back to the Iraq WMD report, going back to your quote, if you want it really bad, you get it really bad. What's your analysis of the flaws in that report? We are understanding that one of them was time pressure. Other than time pressure, how did it get that bad?
Mm-hmm. I'll try to simplify this because it's a different answer for each of the parts. The worst was the nuclear, but the nuclear was the one that was pointed to. Quotations about can't have the smoking gun be a mushroom cloud kind of thing. There was what I regard as a rather blatant disregard for expertise on this one. There were some judgments made around aluminum tubes and what they could be used for. And the Department of Energy specialists who build centrifuges said it wouldn't work. We in INR went to the company that makes the type of centrifuge that was being cut, said wouldn't work. We went to the Brits who build these things, said it wouldn't work. There was evidence on certain types of magnets that were ordered, ring magnets that could be used in this, but they have many, many applications. If you didn't assume they were for centrifuges, you could have judged them to be used in many other. In fact, we now know they were ordered for part of the missile program. The keeping of nuclear scientists together, an assertion that was made in there, and it was extrapolated from a very small number of people, keeping the nuclear. But again, because of the UN investigations, the IAEA investigations, work that DOE had, we had the names of hundreds of people who had been involved in the program up until 1990. And we knew where most of them worked. And most of them actually had important day jobs in military industries. So there was an easier explanation. So there were a lot of things that, in the end, was sloppy analysis, truly sloppy analysis. And this will sound harsh, but the terrible NIE that is blamed for having such a deleterious impact, in fact, was read by almost nobody. It's really quite striking because of its classification, it had to be signed out. So we know that hundreds of people were claimed that they were misled by something they hadn't read. I haven't figured out the explanation for that yet. But there's a gap between effect and quality. The final generalized problem is that there was a bias that was more like a lawyer than an analyst. And it's we've translated into training programs. With a lawyer, it's got a bottom line, go get it. Find the precedents, build the argument that makes the case. Saddam was evil. He'd had chemical weapons. He'd had biological programs. He'd had a nuclear program. He had a missile program. He had it once. He must have it. If we're not finding it, it's because he's good at hiding it. So evidence was systematically interpreted to make the case, not looked at to say, what are the alternative ways in which you could account for this observed phenomenon? That's the biggest flaw in it. Now, the chemical weapons was a bad source. The biological one was grab bag, that he'd had this, he had that, he had that, so he might still have it all, even though the evidence. The missile one turned out to be mostly right on this. So it was an uneven performance. But fundamentally, it was failure to consider alternative hypotheses.
There's so many interesting questions about not only the reform of the intelligence community, but the current status of the intelligence community. Let me just ask you a few of those. You said that 50% of the analysts, I guess in your shop or in the community, have joined since 9/11. That says to me that recruitment is going well. Yes. And how about recruitment in some of the areas like Arabic speakers in which there has been a deficit in the past?
Yeah, there are two different dimensions. That the upsurge in patriotism, commitment to public service, and so forth after 9/11 continues. That we get phenomenal candidates for jobs, able to pick from many, many highly qualified people, including language capabilities. However, it's not even. Because of the security clearance problem, and this is a whole separate area of reform that we have undertaken, it makes it very hard to bring in exactly the people that we want and need who are first or second generation because they have relatives still living in Iran, Iraq, Syria, and so forth. We've done something which I think is, I'm proud of, it's pretty creative. CIA and the Office of Director of National Intelligence did this together. They said, there are people we want. It'll take a long time to find out if we clear them. They may not get cleared. But they're young people. They need a paycheck. They're good enough to work for us. They're good enough to find other jobs. Why don't we build a building or rent a building and say everything in there is unclassified? And we'll put them to work on that open source intelligence, regular information, and just put them to work. And it's been very successful. They're doing tremendous work. Some of them will get cleared and come in. Some of them won't get cleared. If they've done a good job, they'll stay there. If they don't do a good job and don't get cleared, we'll say thank you very much, goodbye. But it is, a creative way to deal with the problem. We are trying to tackle this, change the risk calculus of hiring people. Since almost everybody ultimately makes it through the clearance process, let's just make it easier to bring them in, but monitor their behavior, monitor their keystrokes on the computer, monitor their finances and so forth. This is a way of doing it that will allow us to bring people in. That's part of a larger government-wide reform that goes way beyond the intelligence community, and it's slow.
I assume everyone understands the limitations in the U.S. intelligence community on hiring people who are first-generation immigrants or have relatives in countries that are of concern, security concern to the U.S. Everyone understands that, and therefore why this is a creative solution. I don't know how far you can go in talking about this. Can you tell us what the highest priorities of the intelligence community are today in terms of regional mm-hmm. focus and functional focus?
I can, and I can point you. It's the time of year for the budget where we do our annual threat assessment for the Congress. And DNI, Director of National Intelligence, Mike McConnell, presented two unclassified sessions of this last week. I did one yesterday to the House Armed Services Committee. They're on various websites. Very brief, it's terrorism, counterproliferation, cyber threat. That, you know, our society, our banking system, our power grids, everything are hooked up, wired together, digitally, stuff moving around on glass pipes, and it's vulnerable. Iran is a regional threat. Instability in a variety of places, federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan where Al-Qaeda is housed, various African countries. Energy security, those are the highest ones. And military modernization, Russia and China, some of which puts at risk some of our weapon systems.
There are a number of comments from attendees about the way that the Iraq WMD report might have been read or ignored or shaped by political agendas and so on. There's another question. Were there pressures from the White House or elsewhere in the government to suppress or modify the assessment of Iran's nuclear weapons program, the most recent one?
That I can say categorically. There was absolutely no pressure, interference from the White House or anywhere else in the administration. That's not meant to try and bound it. That the I've been at this quite a while. And one of the things that is sort of deeply ingrained in analysts is to have alarm bells go off and start acting like a wild man when they think somebody is improperly trying to exert political influence on his or her judgments. I have an ombudsman who's available and who, when we try to fireproof this estimate every way we could. I had my evaluation standard people go over it. I had the ombudsman sort of reach out. Is the short answer, that the administration did not interfere in this.
So Iran is a political decision away from nuclear weapons. Can you, obviously, from an open source perspective, can you talk about that a little bit more? What does that mean, and how long would it take them to implement such a political decision?
The judgment in the estimate, and I'm not going beyond what's sort of in the unclassified, if you actually read it and understand what you're reading here, we didn't change the timeline on how long they would have fissile material. We didn't change our timeline on how long it would take them to have a device. A device is something like the North Koreans have. It'll go bang on the ground. It'll go bang someplace. Harder to make it deliverable and to get it small. But that though there is a lot that we do not know about how far along they were in this process. Unfortunately, the technology to make simple nuclear weapons is now 70 years old. And it's pretty readily understood, widely available. The key is fissile material, and the hard part is the miniaturization for development. So it wouldn't take long, in our judgment.
Back to the reform in the intelligence community, what incentives are in place to reward good analysis and prediction and punish ineffectual analysis?
This is actually a tough subject to work with, holding people accountable. I mentioned Intellipedia not being anonymous. It's one of the ways we want people to develop a reputation, first with their peers, and ultimately with the people they support. One of the reasons we wanted to leave in place the 16 agencies where people are close to the customers that they work with, people do have a reputation. Reputations matter. That I've seen enough instances where the question, who made that call? And the answer is, you know, that was Sophie, that was Jim. It's a, okay, I'll go with it. I don't need to ask any more questions. They got and it was who? And it'll be dismissed in there. We're trying to work so that those who are getting too many of the who, we retrain them, we move them around, we weed them out. We're working at agency level now, not individual. I do, and this is in the law, and I do an annual report to the Congress, which is unclassified, you can find that, that looks at pathologies in written products, analytic products across the community. And we feed that back into training. We look at in particular, you've got a problem on Latin America. Other things you do is pretty good, but Latin America, pretty bad. Why? And go to work on it. The holding people accountable in the 9/11, as some have, boy, I can't think of anything that would be more destructive here. Analysis in the role of intelligence is inherently skating on thin ice, is inherently playing with inadequate information. If this wasn't hard, we wouldn't need to spend a whole lot of money paying guys like me to do what we do. You're going to get safe calls. And I have upset people when I've said, and I'll say it again, we're right most of the time. We bat way over Hall of Fame qualification kind of averages, and that bothers me. Not because I don't like being right, but because I think we ask too many easy questions. I'm much more concerned about tackling things that are really hard and pushing back the frontier of understanding a little bit than I am fattening the batting average. By bunting against a slow third baseman.
What's the Intellipedia?
Intellipedia is a classified version of Wikipedia that we started it up about 2.5 years ago. And part of it was sort of responding to the way our younger workforce lives in a digital realm. In part, it was aimed at getting collaboration of people who could work on a project regardless of their current job. What is a mechanism that we can do it? So we moved a number of articles in, and we started this. Take these numbers as orders of magnitude rather than precise, because I've forgotten the precise. But it took us with the Intellipedia about 2 months less to get 1 million edits to articles than it took the Wikipedia on the World Wide Web. The whole world took about 2 years. I've got now somewhere on the order of 16,000 people in the Intellipedia. And it is part of it is they learned out there in Wikipedia land and brought that skill in and use it, that we've got hundreds of thousands of pieces that have been written on it. We're now in the, this thing succeeded so much more rapidly than we anticipated. We are, what are the criteria for putting the equivalent of an agency seal of I stand behind this? That it's not just analysts messing around here. We're trying to produce living documents that are continuously, collectively updated, instead of trying to remember somebody wrote something on the military infrastructure of Venezuela. It was pretty good. Who was that? Where was it? Where do I find it? Here it is on the site. It's done and vouched for and then easily updated. We're now struggling, and I've said I need a straw man in 2 months that we can roll out that uses our evaluative criteria as well as reality criteria. I had to get it to the ambassador. The commander needed it in CENTCOM that brings it in there. But it is Wikipedia. The difference is names are on it. We want people to have the equivalent of an eBay reputation.
That concept of reputation, one can spin that out a little bit, the intelligence community version of Friendster or MySpace or whatever, mm-hmm. where you have the more friends you have, the better you're thought of. We are at the point where we can have only one more question, and this is a bit of a tough one. When some people hear about integrating national security and law enforcement, the alarm bells go mm-hmm. off about mm-hmm. civil liberties. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are sufficient protections against our national security capabilities being utilized in inappropriate ways within the domestic context in this drive to integrate collection internally and externally and protect American citizens wherever they are?
I hope so. I believe so. I mean, one of the things that sort of kind of important to the reality here, that there is a reality even in a theme park, that most of us who are sort of working this hard are children of the 60s. This isn't some abstract thing. This was formative to us. The J. Edgar Hoover abuse, the CIA abuses, the Pike Commission kind of stuff, that the people who are at the top making these decisions care passionately about it. The law created within our office a Civil Liberties Protection Office that its sole responsibility is to look at everything we do and everything that is proposed in light of civil liberties. And Alex Joel, who heads it, is, you know, the kind of a of exactly the kind of a, I was tempted to use the word zealot, but that implies a negative, that he's deadly serious about this, that he's not going to rubber stamp anything on it, that striking the right balance, getting it right. One of the reasons I bristle every time the newspapers write something is the product of the 16 spy agencies. No, there's 16 analytic components, most of whom don't spy, and certainly don't spy on Americans. This integration, and I'll go a little beyond it, has produced things that really are clashes of culture. That those of us who've grown up in foreign intelligence, you get an American person, that name goes out. It's removed from the report before it is out. You see that it's, get that away, take it out of my computer. You go to jail for this stuff. And are really serious about it. You move into the law enforcement world and the homeland security world, there's all kinds of poison pen kind of stuff to slander the neighbor because he parked on my too close to my driveway, and things that have to be run down as leads in law enforcement. Now as we put people that come to these two communities and they have task force and integrated, you've got one that says, well, we got to have that. If we don't know who it is, how do we go to their house? And the other one says, if I look at that report, my career's finished. There are some sort of practical things to be worked through. The bias in the system is protecting civil liberties.
Our thanks to Dr. Thomas Finger, Deputy Director of National Intelligence, Chairman of the National Intelligence Council. Thank you to our audience here on the radio, on the internet, on television. I'm Gloria Duffy, and now this special Valentine's Day meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you all.